Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Back, Blood River Radio fans, we are going to bookend the show today. The first hour was about the future of the South and Southern independence from this evil U.S. regime. And this final hour is going to be a Confederate history lesson with our good friend Gene Andrews. We're going to learn some stuff today about the formation of the Confederate Marine Corps. Bet you didn't even know we ever had one. All right, Gene, welcome to the show. And lead us off, sir.
Thank you very much. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Blood River Radio and talk to our Southern compatriots out there and kind of bring us up to date on our Southern history. We were talking before we came on the air there about how we try to have our history match up the month so they can sort of relate to what happened in January, February, March, and so forth. And last show, and I had to miss the previous Saturday, but the show before that, we were talking about Confederate General Patrick Claiborne, who was born in County Cork, Ireland, immigrated to the U.S. He and his brother and sister through the port of New Orleans went up to Cincinnati, and then he came back downriver and got a job working in an apothecary or drugstore, we call it now, in Helena, Arkansas, got his law degree, and because of the training he had had in the British Army, he was elected captain of the local militia company and then rose to the rank of colonel of the 15th Arkansas Regiment. They took him across the river. He fought at Shiloh and fought in every major battle that the Army of Tennessee fought in Murfreesboro, Perryville, Kentucky, Richmond, Kentucky, and then all through the Atlanta campaign. Of course, he was tragically killed at the Battle of Franklin. Which should have never happened. And had he been a Corps commander or Army commander, that battle would have never been fought. The Schofield's Yankee Corps would have been cut off at Spring Hill down south of Franklin on the night of the 29th of November, and the Battle of Franklin on the 30th would have never been caught. I wanted to read something that I didn't have time to cover all this. I was talking too much on other stuff on General Claiborne's day. Some comments about him that said... he was referred to as the Stonewall of the West in reference to Stonewall Jackson in the East. And General William J. Hardy was his corps commander, and he said, referring to Claiborne and his division, he declared, his fall was a greater loss to the cause he fought for than of any other Confederate leader after Stonewall Jackson. And then General Hardy also said, where his division defended, no odds broke its lines. Where it attacked, no numbers resisted its onslaught, save only once. And there is the grave of Claiborne and his heroic division. So that's what type of person Patrick Claiborne was. And the Irish pronounce it like it's C-L-A-Y-B-U-R-N. Of course, we call it Claiborne over here. And there's a town in Texas, Claiborne, Texas, that was a lot of the soldiers after the war. Everything was destroyed in the South and they moved out west and were there at... in that part of Texas, and they named the town after their commanding general. And I've been there. There's a beautiful statue of General Claiborne there in Claiborne, Texas. And then there's another town not far away, Granbury, Texas, where Hiram Granbury was a brigade commander under General Claiborne, and he was also killed at Franklin. So Granbury, Texas, and his statue are out there. And they're small enough towns that they're not overrun by carpetbaggers and the offended hyphen Americans. So when all the protests and everything over St. George Floyd were going on, they told the people right out front and said, no, we're not taking these statues down, and don't even come in here and protest and even talk about that. So hooray for Texas. I'm proud of them. One other thing, we're going to give a little shout out here to one of our most loyal supporters for Blood River, Biscuit, from a southern state that's helped out the cause with donations. And he came up to Tennessee this last week, I met him at a motel down south of Nashville, and we went on a tour. He wanted to see the Bedford Forest Boyhood Home. We went over to Chapel Hill, took him out to lunch. Then we came back through Franklin and showed him the Claiborne Monument on Winstead Hill there that's owned and operated by our SCV camp, Sam Davis Camp, Sons of Confederate Veterans. And the Arkansas Monument has that quote on it from General Hardee about where his division attacked that never resisted save once, and there is the grave of Claiborne. And then we went to a couple other historic sites. He gave a fantastic donation to the Forest Home, which we are very appreciative of. Biscuit is a loyal, hard-fighting Confederate even today, and we're so proud to have him within our ranks and have his expertise on Confederate history. It was a most enjoyable day, just driving around Middle Tennessee and seeing all these Confederate sites, and really enjoyed his company and his historical knowledge and all the things he did. So with that out of the way, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give you a little bit of a preview of what we're going to do in April. April the 12th, 1864, was the date for the battle at Fort Pillow over on the Mississippi River in West Tennessee. And Forrest's men captured Fort Pillow, and the Yankees never could defeat Forrest on the battlefield, so they concocted this lie, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, about the massacre at Fort Pillow. So we're going to set that straight and tell everybody it was not a massacre. They took out over 200 prisoners. If Forrest ordered a massacre, he didn't do a very good job of it when you take out that many prisoners from 557 that were there. And we'll explain how that turned into a propaganda tirade by the North and the news media today. And then on 14th of April, 1865, a little over a year later, was the occasion where the dictator of the Yankee Empire met a bullet from John Wilkes Booth in Ford's Theater in D.C. And there's an article in the current issue of the Barnes Review, which is a great, great magazine. I highly recommend that if you really want to find out what happened in history and not the myths that are on there. There's an article in there that says the murder of Lincoln was an inside job. And it said, the subtitle was Secretary of War Edwin Stanton orchestrating events. And they go through there and prove how this was set up deal, that Stanton wanted Lincoln killed, and the Booth diary that they caught had, after Booth was killed, they had a diary, and miraculously, there were a lot of the pages that were torn out of it. After it was given to Stanton, and then a lot of the pages disappeared before it was made public. Some of the people that were involved in it that knew what actually happened had mysterious deaths. Fellow that was head of Lafayette Baker, head of the National Detective Bureau, later known as the Secret Service, had a mysterious death where he died of arsenic poisoning so that he couldn't talk. And then, of course, they killed off all the associates with Booth so they couldn't talk. And it's really an interesting article how this is a set-up job. And I've had several people mention that they wanted, you know, revenge against the South during destruction, not reconstruction, but re-destruction after the war for 12 years. And they wanted to make sure that they would not allow the Southerners to elect anyone to Congress, because if the Southern Democrats, which they were before the war, and the Northern Democrats got together, they could turn out this radical Republican Party. And I had one historian say that it might have been the end of the Republican Party. We wouldn't even have a Republican Party today. We'd have another party, but it wouldn't be the original Republican Party that Lincoln was head of. And the other thing that they did during Reconstruction, they wanted to make sure that they drove a wedge between the Southern blacks and the Southern whites so they would never get together and vote on the Democratic ticket. And they wanted to make sure that the blacks and whites hated each other in the South. They did everything they could to promote that and make sure that they never voted together, because then it was guaranteed if blacks voted like their neighbors who were whites and voted Democrat, that would have been the end of the Republican Party. They would have voted them out of office, and no doubt about that. And I can remember that as a little boy back in the 50s and 60s. The only election that counted in Tennessee was the Democratic primary. Usually, a Republican candidate couldn't get enough signatures to even get on the ballot. Or if they did, they might get 10 votes, their mom and dad and their cousins, but that was going to be about it. And I'm sure that that was true for most of the southern states, that the Democratic primary was the only one that counted. Yeah.
Well, you're exactly right, because I can vouch for my native country of Arkansas. There wasn't even an elected Republican official at the state level until 1982. There was a guy that got elected governor that year, and but up until then, there hadn't even been a Republican elected to public office in Arkansas. So
I'm sure it was Mississippi, Alabama, and all the rest of the southern states as well, because of Reconstruction. Okay, we'll go pick up after the break.
We'll be right back, folks. Hang on.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard-right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Hi, welcome back for our last hour here, folks, on Blood River Radio. And Gene, if I can, to just do one thing here before you get going on the Confederate Marine Corps.
Yes, sir.
You're talking about Patrick Claiborne, and he's from my native country of Arkansas, well, at least by way of Ireland. But I just pulled up a couple of very good quotes of his that I'd like to read for the audience, and then I'll turn it back over to you.
Yes, sir.
The first one is, surrender, and I want you to listen to how prophetic this is right here. Surrender means that the history of this heroic struggle will be written by the enemy, that our youth will be trained by Northern school teachers, will learn from Northern school books their version of the war, will be impressed by all the influences of history and education to regard our gallant dead as traitors and our maimed veterans as fit subjects for derision. Now, has that not come true in spades?
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
And then here's one other, and I'll let you have it back, Gene. It is said, slavery is all we are fighting for, and if we give it up, we give up all. Even if this were true, which we deny, slavery is not all our enemies are fighting for. It is merely the pretense to establish sectional superiority and a more centralized form of government and deprive us of our rights and liberties. And once again, has that not come true in truckloads?
Boy, you talk about a prophet in the Old Testament of the Bible. That is certainly a prophet right there, talking about what was going to happen to us if we lost that war. And, and you're absolutely right. It's all come true, just what like he said it was. Yeah.
And the same with General Lee when he wrote to Lord Acton and said that the Yankee victory meant that this all the states would be consolidated into one vast republic, sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home. And once again, that's all come to pass.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're not going to fight any foreign wars, and we're not going to get involved in any regime change. I remember somebody running for president recently that said that, but anyway, we won't get into that today. But but that is so true about General Claiborne. He saw what was coming, and a lot of the Southern officers and politicians did. And they knew what was going to happen once the North was victorious and they could just grind the South under their boot heel into the dirt and put in the dictatorship that we have so many have had for so many years in the federal government in D.C. Okay, well, we got caught up on a lot of good information there. And we'll get back to our subject today. And the reason we're taking the history of the Confederate States Marine Corps today, they were formed in March of 1861. But going back a little bit before that, the history of the Confederate and United States Marine Corps traveled the same road up until 1861. But the history and tradition of Marines, which are defined as fighting troops on board ships, goes back and way back to a much earlier time. The real old core Marines were the Phoenicians, who first had armed troops on their ships of war, and then the Greeks and later the Romans had Marines on their war galleys. Now, the tactical mission of early Marines is pretty much the same as it is today. Number one, they were ship security. They defended the ship from enemy attack or boarding party, or in the reverse, they attacked or boarded the enemy ships. Number two was to capture and hold approaches to a harbor, or number three, enable the fleet to strike a blow on land, a naval attack projected ashore, either by raiding parties or by an amphibious landing. American Marine tradition goes back directly to the Royal Marines of the British Navy. The symbols and traditions of today's Marines are traced back to those Royal Marines, the globe and anchor, but with the Western Hemisphere that we have instead of the Eastern Hemisphere, like the British or Royal Marines, and scarlet and gold from the Royal Marines. And today, Marine Corps signage is usually gold or yellow letters on a red background. During the American Revolution, which was our first war for independence, and the Southern independence was our second war for independence, Continental Marines were formed by an act of the Continental Congress on November 10th, 1775. And at Marine bases all over the world and on board ship, the 10th of November is celebrated with usually a formal dinner and a formal parade or whatever on November 10th as birthday of the Marine Corps. Then after the Continental Marines fought in the Revolution, they were then sent along the northern coast of Africa. Marines fought the Barbary Pirates. This is our first war against the Muslim terrorists from 1801 to 1805. And Marines under the naval commander Stephen Decatur captured the port of Tripoli. And Marine Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon marched overland across the Libyan desert to attack Tripoli from the less defended landside. The Pasha of Tripoli, kind of like a mayor, awarded Lieutenant O'Bannon the Mameluke sword, and a replica of which is carried by Marine officers today. It doesn't have the scabbard around the handle like we have. It's just sort of like a T at the handle. Now, during the War of 1812, Marines were called into service again. They fought at the Battle of Bladensburg outside Washington, D.C., and when the militia broke and ran for the Bladensburg races, that it was called, the Marines held and fell back slowly into Washington. The British were so impressed by the stand made by the Marines that they spared the home of the Marine Commandant when they burned Washington, D.C. And the Commandant's home in Washington is the oldest building in continuous use. It's also the home of the Marine Barracks at 8th and I Street in Washington, the oldest post of the Corps. And if any of y'all ever get to Washington on a Friday night, you need to schedule going to the evening parade at the Marine Barracks. They have the Marine Drum and Bugle Corps, the Marine Band, and then the Silent Drill Team. It's free. You just have to make reservations because a lot of people want to go to that. But I would highly recommend that if you're in D.C. anytime the late spring, summer, early fall. During the Mexican War, the Marines made several amphibious landings in Mexico and California. They made the final assault against the citadel of Chapultepec in Mexico City. They marched with General Winfield Scott to the National Palace, the Halls of the Montezumas, as it was known. And before Semper Fidelis, always faithful, was adopted as the Marine Corps motto, from the shores of Tripoli to the Halls of the Montezumas was the Marine motto. It's kind of a long motto, so they got the Latin version and cut it down quite a bit. The Marines' hymn reversed the chronology, and it goes from the Halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. They got the timing off just a little bit. It's about this time that the term leathernecks began to be applied to the Marines for the high collar they wore on the dress uniforms. Well, with the rise of Yankee imperialism, their disregard for the Constitution, and their attacks against all things Southern, the country began to unravel in the 1850s. The abolitionist zealots of the Northeast hired the terrorists from the Kansas Territory to come east, instigate a slave uprising, and murder all white Southerners. And this was not an idle threat to Southerners. They knew what had happened in the uprising in Haiti and the murder-filled rampage that went on there. In the North, black codes were passed. They were afraid of this happening in the North, in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, which meant that blacks could not stay overnight in those states. So the abolitionists hired John Brown and his followers to attack Harper's Ferry, Virginia in 1859, seize the arsenal there, and then arm the slaves. There were no army troops or militia available, so the Marines from the Marine barracks in D.C. were sent to Harper's Ferry. The commander of the army, General Winfield Scott, sent his most trusted U.S. Army officer, Colonel Robert E. Lee, with the Marines to subdue the terrorist attack at Harper's Ferry. Now, Lee needed someone who could recognize Brown in case there were hostages, so Lee called on a young cavalry officer from the Kansas frontier who was home on leave in Virginia. James Ewell Brown Stewart, we know as Jeb Stewart, was asked to go with Lee and the Marines. Now, here's the irony of the expedition that was leaving on the train that night being sent to Harper's Ferry. The future commander of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, Robert E. Lee, his future cavalry commander, Jeb Stewart, and the future assistant commandant of the Confederate States Marine Corps, Second Lieutenant Israel Green, now in the United States Marine Corps, were all on that train. In 3 years, they would all be serving in the Confederate Army. So when they got to Harper's Ferry, the Marines stormed the engine house and the railroad yards. Brown and his followers were driven back away from the arsenal by armed citizens of Harper's Ferry. Now, do we need to point out the Second Amendment here of why citizens need to be armed? I think it's pretty obvious. After they shot and killed several citizens, the first person they shot and killed, Brown's followers shot and killed, was Hayward Shepherd, a free black man who refused to join Brown's killing party. And they shot him down right out in the street. His white neighbors went running out under a hail of gunfire and grabbed him and drug him out of the street back behind the building, but it's too late. He died back there. Lee praised the Marines in his official report. He said, "I must also ask to express my entire commendation for the conduct of the detachment of Marines who were at all times ready and prompt in the execution of any duty." Lincoln's election, with only 39% of the popular vote, mainly from the Northeast, was the last straw. South Carolina, on December 20th, 1860, voted to leave, and then states began to peacefully and legally leave the Union. The government of the Confederate States of America was established in Montgomery, Alabama, and the election of President Davis and then the Confederate Congress authorized the creation of a Confederate States Marine Corps on March 16, 1861. The birthday of the Confederate States Marine Corps. Congress approved Davis's request and appointed Stephen Mallory of Florida as Secretary of the Navy. And like we said before the show, he had the unenviable task of creating a Navy and a Marine Corps from scratch. We'll pick it up after our break.
All right, hang on, folks, for more good stuff to come.
liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from Town Hall. I'm Mary Rose. Senator James Lankford says Operation Epic Fury has been hugely successful.
You think to be able to drop one munitions on a country thousands of miles away, think of how many people that takes in logistics to get there and refueling and equipment and food and everything else that has to be able to happen. All of those things are happening like clockwork to be able to do it. So their performance has been absolutely exceptional through this process.
Senator Lankford, an Oklahoma Republican, made his comments to the Salem Radio Network. There are reports of Russian drones being sent to Iran.
U.S. and European officials say that Russia is sending a shipment of drones to Iran, including upgraded versions of the drone technology that Tehran originally supplied to Moscow after its invasion of Ukraine. The upgraded drones could carry more advanced anti-jamming technology, cameras, or use satellite internet. European officials say the two sides have been holding active discussions throughout March about transferring the drones from Russia to Iran. The Kremlin has denied the reports. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
A feared attack outside an American bank in Paris has been thwarted.
French authorities say police have stopped a suspected bombing outside a Bank of America building in Paris. An investigation has been opened and investigators have placed one person in custody so far. RTL Radio reported on Saturday officers had spotted two suspects near the building overnight, with one trying to light a device. RTL adds the second suspect got away. Interior Minister Laurent Nunez praised the rapid police response and that security forces had stayed on high alert amid international tensions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has positioned himself as the grassroots favorite in the runoff election to determine the party's Senate nominee. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Diabetes, high blood pressure, anxiety meds, everyone's on them. If you're a 50-year-old male, maybe a bit porky, and you may even have type 2 diabetes, $1 million of term insurance may only cost you about $200 a month. Call Term Provider. Speak with Big Lou at 800-555-2085. Big Lou will find a term life policy for you even if you have type 2 diabetes, are overweight, or have high blood pressure. Term Provider has helped thousands of people like you who think they can't afford term life insurance. To buy $1 million of affordable term life for you, all you need to do is call Big Lou at 800-555-2085. Lou will make sure the scales are tipped in your favor. Call 800-555-2085. Big Lou will answer your call and work to fit you into a term life policy that you can afford. Remember, Big Lou's like you. He's on meds too. Call 800-555-2085 or biglou.com.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band
plays... Well, folks, we're back from the break, and waving the red, white, and blue is a good idea, but it depends on how that red, white, and blue is configured on that flag.
Absolutely. Like a red flag with a blue diagonal cross on it. That's it.
Yeah, that's the red, white, and blue I like to wave around here. But anyway, well, Gene, let's get back to the Confederate Marine Corps.
Yes, sir. We were talking about when they were organized in March of 1861, and Stephen Mallory, head of the Navy, was also in charge of the Confederate Marine Corps from the Department of the Navy. And the Department of the Navy has always given us Marines a hard time, saying, well, yeah, but the Marine Corps is under the Department of the Navy. And I say, yeah, but it was the men's department. So anyway, that's so much for that argument. The Confederate Congress authorized the Confederate States Marine Corps uniform. Gray shell jacket, had black cuffs and collar, blue kepi, the hat, and either blue or white trousers, depending on the weather or season of the year where they were stationed. And the Confederate and U.S. Marines of the day used the inverted hunting horn with the letter M as the Marine Corps emblem. The eagle, globe, and anchor came a lot later than the 1860s. And the Confederate and U.S. Marine Corps of the 1800s had the chevrons turned up, pointed up, instead of down, like the Army uniforms had the chevrons pointed down in those days. The officers had a longer frock coat with gold braid at the sleeves, and another distinguishing mark on a Confederate Marine officer's uniform was what they called a shoulder knot. It was like gold braid on the shoulder of the uniform, and of course, the Confederate Marine officers, like all the Confederate officers, had their rank on their collar, not on the shoulder like they do today. But the shoulder knot was on the Marine officer's uniform. It's like gold braid on a black background. It's kind of almost like in a T pattern. The Commandant of the Confederate Marine Corps was Lloyd James Beale of Maryland. He was formerly an Army major, and he had the rank of colonel in the Confederate Marine Corps, which was the highest rank. The assistant commandant we'd mentioned earlier was Israel Green, who had gone to the expedition to Harper's Ferry and as head of the Marine detachment that went. He had the rank of major, and Congress authorized 10 companies or 1,000 men, but only approximately about 650 to 680 officers and enlisted men served in the Confederate Marine Corps. There were recruiting stations all over the port cities in the South, and one of the most successful was in Memphis. They raised an entire company out of Memphis for the Confederate Marine Corps. The headquarters Marine Corps was on Broad Street in Richmond, but the heart of the Corps was Camp Beale at Drury's Bluff on the James River below Richmond. This was a training camp for officers and enlisted men. As mentioned earlier, the Marines' number one job was ship security. There was a Confederate Marine detachment on Captain Raphael Sims' first commerce raider, the Sumter. And after Sims had slipped past the blockade at the mouth of the Mississippi River, the Sumter destroyed Yankee merchant ships all over the Caribbean and Atlantic. And finally, Sims had to sail the worn-out ship to the British at Gibraltar. Another commerce raider that the Confederates had was the Shenandoah. And this was built in Liverpool, England, and purchased by the Confederates. It was one of the fastest state-of-the-art ships of its day. They had three masts for sails, but it also had steam. And the Shenandoah left England, sailed down the Atlantic, crossed the Indian Ocean, and picked up a detachment of Marines in Melbourne, Australia, then headed up north and completely destroyed the U.S. whaling fleet in the Bering Sea. Captain James Waddell had the detachment of Marines, as we said, recruited from Melbourne. And after burning the whaling fleet, there were no more targets. They headed down south out of the Bering Sea for a raid on San Francisco. They stopped a British ship to make sure it was legitimately a British ship, not a U.S. ship flying a British flag, and they were. And they had newspapers, and the British told them, "We're sorry, mates, but your war has been over for about 2 months." So they didn't want to be considered a a pirate ship. They dumped their cannons overboard, sailed down the west coast of the U.S., the west coast of South America, rounded the Horn, came back up the Atlantic, recrossed the equator, and surrendered the last official flag of the Confederacy on the Mersey River in Liverpool, England, on November the 6th, 1865. Now, there were no Marines on the most famous of all the Confederate commerce raiders, the CSS Alabama, but there was a Marine officer, Lieutenant Beckett Howell. He was the brother of Virginia Howell Davis, so he was the brother-in-law of President Jefferson Davis. There was a Confederate gun crew on the CSS Virginia in the battle at Hampton Roads, Virginia, in March of 1862. And this, we talked about earlier, is one of those ironies of history. Stephen Mallory, when he was a senator from Florida in the U.S. Congress, was chairman of the Senate on Naval Affairs, and he wanted the U.S. to build ironclad ships. He said England and France are building ironclad ships. In the next war, that's what we're going to have to fight against. The Navy traditionalist rejected the idea, but he did get the Navy to agree to six, and remember the number six, new steam sail frigates. And the Secretary of the Navy on President Davis's cabinet, they built a casement over the hull of the old USS frigate, the Merrimack, that was sunk in the Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk, Virginia, when the U.S. abandoned it. And in only one morning, Mallory's new iron ship rammed and sank the Cumberland, set the Congress on fire, which later blew up, battered and ran the Minnesota aground. So the CSS Virginia knocked out three of the six modern U.S. Navy ships that Mallory had worked so hard to get while he was a senator in the United States Senate. The same Marines served the next day on the first battle of ironclad ships against the USS Monitor. One interesting thing here, after an iron casement was placed over the hull of the old Merrimack, the old line traditionists in the Confederate Navy didn't want any part of this newfangled invention if this thing floated like a rock. So five Confederate Marines had to man the bow and stern lines as it slid down the dry dock into the water at Gosport Navy Yard, Norfolk. And so that's kind of ironic that the Navy didn't want to launch their ships. They had to get the Marines to launch their ship for them. There was a Marine gun crew on board the CSS Tennessee in the battle at Mobile Bay, and the smaller wooden ships were driven off by the U.S. fleet. Only the Tennessee was left to take on Farragut's fleet. The Tennessee, along with the guns of Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines, fought 19 enemy warships in a six-hour battle in Mobile Bay. Marines manned other forts around Mobile Bay, and it took the U.S. over a month to finally capture the city of Mobile and close it to blockade runners. The second tactical mission of Marines would provide security for naval bases. There were Confederate Marines at Gosport Navy Yard, Norfolk, New Orleans, Pensacola, and Rockets Landing Navy Yard just below Richmond on the James River. Confederate Marines from the Pensacola Squadron raided and burned the camp of the 6 New York Volunteers on Santa Rosa Island near Fort Pickens, right outside Pensacola, after the New Yorkers had looted and burned civilian homes in Pensacola. It's kind of payback time. Another tactical mission of Marines were man the coastal defenses. Confederate Marines received an official thanks from the Confederate Congress after the battle at Drury's Bluff on the James River, where they manned two of the heavy artillery pieces up on the bluff. But then there were also Marines up and down the shoreline, and the deadly fire of Marine snipers along the bank of the James River below the bluff reduced the concentration and accuracy of the U.S. gunners on ships that were coming up the James River. Around Charleston, Marines served as gun crews on board the ironclads of the Charleston Squadron, such as the CSS Charleston, and served on gun crews at Fort Moultrie and out at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. The Marine Barracks Charleston received special training to practice boarding Yankee ironclads and throw glass jars of gunpowder wrapped in turpentine down the smokestacks and air vents. The Monitors never got close enough to try this risky plan. The Marines served at Fort Fisher in North Carolina, which kept Wilmington, North Carolina, open for blockade runners till pretty much the end of the war. Confederate Marines were at Fort Fisher and Battery Buchanan on the Fear River. And the battle at Wilmington on February 1865 was the only time where Confederates and U.S. Marines were in battle at the same time, but on widely separated parts of the field and never really up against each other. The fifth tactical mission of the Marines, form raiding parties or make amphibious landings. There was a plan to raid the prisoner of war camp at Point Lookout, Maryland in the summer of 1864. The Marines had 5,000 extra rifles. They were going to arm the prisoners, but coordination with the cavalry failed to materialize when Early's raid on Washington was delayed, and also the plan was compromised by a spy. But one amphibious plan was at least partially successful. The Navy and Marine raid on New Bern, North Carolina, in the dead of winter in January of 1865. 25 Marines and sailors, wrapped in blankets and huddled in boats strapped to flat cars, were taken by train from Richmond down to the Neuse River. They rowed down the river in the New Bern Sound to attack the USS Underwriter, the largest U.S. gunboat in North Carolina waters. And we'll pick all this up and close it out when we come back to our last segment.
All right. Be right back in a minute or two.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
All right, folks, we're back for our last 15 minutes of the show this weekend. And, Gene, let's pick up where we left off.
Okay, before the break, we were talking about the Marines and Navy attempt to capture the USS Underwriter, which is a gunboat in North Carolina waters. They got down there, scrambled on board, subdued the crew, and tried to take off with their big prize, but the steam was too low in the boilers to move the ship. They even tried towing it with lines to their rowboats, but the larger ship was too heavy to tow, and they were under fire from the Fort Stevens and along the harbor there. With casualties mounting, they removed their dead and wounded, set fire to the ship. The fire went out, volunteers went back, climbed up on board, reset the fire, waited till it caught, and only then they escaped. And Marines served in a wide variety of duty stations. There was a Confederate Marine officer that had a Nashville connection. Lieutenant Henry Doak was born in Washington County in East Tennessee. Interesting individual. He tried to enlist in the Mexican War when he was only 4 years old. And they thanked him for his enthusiasm, but they said he ought to wait a little while. And so he did. He came back next year when he was 5 riding a horse. He figured maybe they wouldn't notice how short he was then. They turned him down again, but thanked him. But later on, he was studying law in Knoxville, enlisted in the 19th Tennessee Infantry Regiment when the war came along. He got a battlefield promotion to lieutenant at Mill Springs in Kentucky, was wounded at Shiloh and was recuperating at home when he read about the Marines at Drury's Bluff, asked for and received a transfer to the Confederate States Marine Corps, and then went through officer's training at Drury's Bluff, and his first duty station was in Charleston, South Carolina. He commanded a Marine gun crew on the CSS Charleston, and along with other ships of the Charleston Squadron, defeated three amphibious attacks on Charleston defenses. Now, the siege of Charleston, South Carolina, was the longest siege of any city in the Western Hemisphere, over 3 years, and much of the Yankee destruction was directed at Charleston's civilian population. They used the church steeples in Charleston as aiming points, and this could be classified as America's worst terrorist attack. There was a higher percentage of civilians in Charleston killed by the U.S. Army bombardment of Charleston than the percentage of the population of New York civilians that were killed in 9/11. Later on, Lieutenant Doak was transferred to Wilmington, North Carolina, and once again, he was in charge of a gun crew on another ironclad, the CSS Raleigh, which broke the blockade at Wilmington, and then posted on the CSS Tallahassee, one of these commerce raiders. They slipped past the federal blockade and headed north to take out the shipping lanes between New York City and Nova Scotia. In 3 weeks, they sank or ransomed 33 ships, and they were headed for a raid on the Brooklyn Navy Yard, but they were low on coal and didn't want to get trapped inside the Verrazano Narrows, so they headed back to Wilmington. Well, unfortunately, the spring of 1865 signaled the end of the Confederate States Marine Corps, like the rest of the Confederacy. After the sinking of the Alabama off the coast at Cherbourg, France, Admiral Sims escaped capture, was picked out of the water in the English Channel by a British yacht, returned to the Confederacy through Matamoros, Mexico, got across the Mississippi River on a homemade raft, and reported to Richmond for orders. He was given command of the James River Squadron, the only Confederate ships left. When the Petersburg lines broke and Lee's army had to retreat out of Richmond and Petersburg, and Richmond was evacuated, the James River Squadron was sunk to block the James Rivers to prevent the U.S. Navy from being the first enemy to enter the Confederate capital. Part of the Marines and sailors went with Lee toward Amelia Courthouse and part with Sims toward Danville, Virginia. Marines and sailors fought at Sailor's Creek, where most were either killed or captured, but a few survived and actually surrendered with Lee at Appomattox Courthouse. Sims, with naval and Marine detachments, turned south toward North Carolina when they learned of Lee's surrender. Marines from Wilmington, who had defended the city after the fall of Fort Fisher, served under Joseph E. Johnston and fought at the Battle of Bentonville, North Carolina, in March of 1865. Those Marines and ones under Admiral Sims surrendered with Johnston at Bennett Farmhouse in April of 1865, about 2 weeks after Lee's army surrendered at Appomattox. Marines surrendered at the Charlotte Naval Ordnance Department, the Augusta Powder Works, and defensive positions at the northern end of Mobile Bay. There was a Marine escort with President Davis when he was trying to get away from Richmond and continue the war west of the Mississippi River. They were sent away with part of the Confederate Treasury to pay Davis's escort and with President Davis's personal papers. And so this is the tragic and all too brief history of the Confederate States Marines, Confederate States of America, and her Marine Corps. Rebel Leathernecks had served from the Bering Sea to Gibraltar on land from New Orleans to the James River. The Confederate Marine Corps had ended, but the spirit of Confederates in the Marine Corps still exists. And when I was in Vietnam, there were Confederate flags at every Marine fire support base in northern Quang Tri Province. They weren't so anti-Confederate back then when they had Southern boys that were willing to risk their life for the U.S. of A. government. The only place they banned the Confederate flag, and all flags, in fact, was right up on the DMC. They didn't want anything sticking up on the horizon, U.S. flag, Confederate state flag, or anything that could be used as an aiming point. And they even bent the radio antennas over, so there was nothing coming up above the horizon that would make it easy for the North Vietnamese gunners to judge the distance of where they were firing out of the demilitarized zone into South Vietnam. So it was interesting to me to do all the research and find out that, yes, the Confederate States of America did have a Marine Corps under their Department of the Navy, and they served in ports, like I said, from the Gulf all the way around the Gulf ports and up the east coast of the Atlantic and on ships literally all over the world, the Bering Sea, North and South Atlantic, the Caribbean, as Marine detachments on board of some of these ships. So it was an interesting example of the variety of different duty stations that Confederate Marines served in all over the world. So I hope our listeners got a little bit more of our Confederate history there, kind of an unknown part of Confederate history. And like I said, when we get into April, I'm going to have to be gone that first weekend. I'm going to have a table set up to sell things for the Forest Home at the Tennessee Military Collectors Association the first weekend in April. But then the second one, weekend, I think that's close to the 12th, we will discuss Forrest at Fort Pillow and give our listeners an accurate account of what really happened there and not the northern propaganda that we've been beaten over the head with that Patrick Claiborne warned about. If we lost the war, our history is going to be taught by northern school teachers, and we'll have to listen to their version of history, which is basically nothing but propaganda. So I hope that helped our audience out with a little bit of our Confederate history, and certainly enjoyed being on the program with you today. So,
always glad to have you here, Gene. You're a wealth of knowledge, and would that more of our people would study our true history and get excited about it again, you know, rather than all of this American rubbish stuff that they seem to consume to no end. So,
we have to know our history to refute the lies and propaganda that are thrown against us. And all you need to do is know the facts, because the things they say about the South, it's basically just propaganda from the news media, from the politicians, from whoever. And I get invited to the local TV stations or a debate or something once. They never ask me back again because they can't argue with the facts, and they don't want me back there. So I'm not what they expect as a Southern stereotype or something, I guess.
Yeah, you know, Gene, I've said the same thing in relation to our contemporary bid for reigniting the desire for Southern independence, is that there's a real good reason why CNN or even Fox News or any other major media outlet will never have Dr. Michael Hill or myself or anybody else involved with Southern nationalism on one of their discussion panels, because as soon as we start talking, the jig is up.
Yep.
Everybody will realize that all those other people are a bunch of lying blowhards, you know. So there
exactly.
You go.
Even Fox, and that always got me listening to Rush Limbaugh or some of these so-called conservatives, and they talk about how corrupt the federal government was. It was too bloated. It was this, that, and the other. And then they turn right around and praise Lincoln, and he saved the Union. And I thought, well, who do you think created this federal dictatorship? They don't know much about history, because they don't know who started the ball rolling on all this federal nonsense that we have now. So anyway,
the cognitive dissonance is just astounding.
Yes. Oh yeah. So anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'll say, because once upon a time I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh, and no doubt about it, he was one of the biggest Lincoln lovers there that ever walked, you know. So God rest his soul.
Had a lady on there from the South that went through what we know about Lincoln, you know, what a liar he was. And he admitted he needed to go to the South into a war to fire the first shot, so he had an excuse to invade the South. And she was telling all this. He cut her off right in the middle of a sentence and booted her off the radio. They didn't want any of that to get out. So
The Lincoln myth must be protected at all costs, because that's what justifies the existence of the U.S. Empire.
Well, okay, folks, and thank you for giving me some time, and I hope our listeners learned a little bit about a kind of an unknown branch of the Confederate military today. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gene. Appreciate you being on. Folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of Blood River Radio. And if your budget will allow, please donate to help support Blood River so that we can continue to put this kind of truthful and helpful information out there for you. God save the South, and God bless all of you, and we'll see you again next week.